Hello, everybody. This is Dan Gentry with the Standing Back Up Podcast. Today, my special guest is Mr. Nico Morales, author. How you doing, my friend?
Doing great, Dan, man. Enjoying this beautiful day and all being grateful for the blessing of another day, man. How are you?
I'm doing great, man. You know, that's one of the best ways to start our day is with that gratitude, huh?
Absolutely. It's a lost art for sure, and it opens up so many doors.
Without a doubt, man. We get so caught up on everything else, and sometimes we forget the little things, man. All right, man, where'd you grow up at?
Albuquerque, New Mexico, Albuquerque. The Duke City, bro. You ever been?
Long time ago, man. You know, I got a troubled past and I was on the run, and I was in Houston, Texas, and my brother's ex-wife was working at the Holiday Inn out there. She was kind of one of the big wigs. I went there just briefly, flew out there and drove back.
Nice, man. Yeah. Land of enchantment is what they call it. From here, we call it the land of entrapment. So I'm glad that you were able to get back to Houston.
Yeah, no, Ken. We drove back. It was a long ride. I remember that, man. I was strung out on dope. I was on pills, took pain pills at the time, man. And I took a bunch out there with me. I barely made it to the airport. That was pre 9/11, but about got hemmed up in the airport, but made it through, man.
Shit. On the run with pills in the airport. There's some things that when we look back at our decision making, it's, man, just like, but what was going on in our heads?
We just think we're so smart. You know, that's the thing about it. You know, oh, man, they're not going to catch me. Then we get caught and it's like, man, what are you doing messing with me, man?
Yeah, I didn't do anything. I didn't do anything wrong. You don't get it.
You don't get it. So I see you as an athlete, man. What sport did you play?
My favorite sport that I did pretty well in was wrestling. There was something about beating somebody up without getting in trouble that I really enjoyed.
Yeah, I get that. I understand, man. You know, they don't like us putting our hands on people nowadays, that's for sure.
Yeah. You go and put somebody in a chokehold now, pick them up and slam them on their head, and you got way more issues. But in wrestling, a double leg, single leg takedown, fireman's carry, and then just choking someone out. There was something, Dane, that I used to enjoy. Like, I get them into a headlock, lift up their head, and I could just see their eyes get a little bit wider and wider and wider and wider as the fear grew up in their head.
Right.
And that was just a kick to me. I enjoyed it.
That adrenaline rush, man.
Yeah.
How did
combat, right? Combat, going back and forth with another human being. I think as men, we're supposed to be able to do that.
Yeah.
And so it's a good test and a good outlet for it.
Yeah, I definitely had a lot of combat in my lifetime against another man. That's for sure, man. You know, I'm getting too old for that stuff now, though. We don't heal up the same as we used to, man. You know what I mean?
Hey, it takes longer. You find that you have more muscles than you really knew that you could hurt, right?
You know, used to, man. You have a fight, it wasn't a big deal. The next day now, I can't hardly get out of bed and walk and all that good stuff.
Absolutely. Man, shoot, I opened up the can the wrong way and my hand starts to hurt. I'm like,
I know, that's right.
I used to put this on people's faces, on get hit with things. Like, now you busted it on a can opener.
Yeah, we're getting soft, man. Getting soft in our old age. How'd you grow up, man? What was your childhood like?
You know, man, I really had a decent childhood. When I compare it to other individuals that I was around, I had a decent childhood. Both parents were in my household, so that's one thing that was a positive. Middle class, New Mexico, which is lower class United States, that's what a lot of people in my community don't seem to understand, is that we're fighting at the bottom of the crab bucket. I'm still here in New Mexico, but yeah, new middle class. We didn't really have too many wants or needs that went missing, right? Like, there was always food on the table. It might have just been a bowl of beans with some cheese on it for the night, but that it was food. Can't complain about that. We used to go on family trips every once in a while. El Paso, I used to get sent out to over the summers. My dad would send me to go stay with one of his brothers. So I just go travel that way. That's the broad topic of it, right? That's the best part about it. The negative parts about it was that I dealt with rejection at a very young age. I got a younger sister, and she got sick after her first year of being born. So we're 2 years apart. And when she was born, she was healthy, but the doctors messed up. And when they messed up, they caused her some pretty bad illnesses. And they told my parents that she wasn't going to live past the first couple years of her life. So my grandmother took me from the hospital after my sister was in the hospital, and she raised me from ages 2 to 6, at least for the first 2 years, I should say, 2 to 4. I was with my grandma most of the time. And then from 4 to 6, I spent a lot of time with them. My grandma and my papa, they went back and forth between New Mexico and Arizona because that's where they're originally from. And, you know, that's just the way that it was. My mom was at the hospital with my sister. My dad was working, so there wasn't anybody that could really look out for Nico. Right. And being in the hospital as a kid, that's not the fun place to be. So being in the car with my grandparents was a lot better. But that's where I identified one of my root issues of missing out, like not feeling accepted. And that caused me the mentality, because it all boils down to a mental mindset of where we're at, that I wasn't loved, I wasn't welcomed, I wasn't wanted. And those type of thought processes, the longer I kept them in my head without working them, caused me larger issues. So about 6 years old, my papa, he died. And that's where I felt that rejection again, right? As a kid, you don't understand death. No. So it's just like, man, someone else is leaving me here. And that propelled me into substance use. I got high for the first time when I was 14 years old, just to be accepted, just to be wanted, just to be included with the guys. And the guys that wanted to include me, they were gang members. So I remember that at 14, I was at a brand new high school and didn't have any homies, didn't have no friends. And there was a 2 tiers at the high school, right? And,
right.
I was hanging out on the bottom tier. And one of the guys, he's like, hey, Nico, just saw me chilling by myself. He's like, why don't you come kick it with us? And I was like, yeah, somebody wants me to be accepted. That's an amazing feeling.
Yeah.
And turns out he was a part of a gang. Turns out his homies were a part of a gang. Turns out his older brother was a part of a gang. Turns out his dad was a part of a gang.
Wow. And whole family affair.
Yeah. And so just being the need of being included is what got me involved with them. Now, I never got ranked into the gang just because I understood the way that world worked. But being aligned or affiliated with them for me wasn't a big deal.
Right.
And that's probably where the identity starts to imprint. Decision making and identity are two of our biggest things. And since I could handle myself wrestling, you know, that translated into fighting. So whenever the homies got into a fight,
you wanted to be there.
Yeah, I could go take a couple punches to the dome and then pick someone up and slam them. And everybody would get all, whoa.
Look at Nico. Yeah.
Yeah. And that acceptance just propelled. So I eventually got asked to leave that school because apparently we were causing too much of a headache for the school. And so they separated us. And at that point, when you're already a bird of a feather, you start to flock together with other individuals, right? So it didn't really matter which school they sent me to. I already had this mentality. One of my favorite things to do was wear my initials on my belt buckle. And at the time, that was the cool way to like sport yourself, right? Right. My initials are NM. So from New Mexico with initials NM, I was just like, man, this is easy. And I also learned there. I'm sorry, go ahead.
I was just going to say, I was on the run again one time. Imagine that. And I was out in Arizona, man. I ended up in Tucson. And what was it? 520, I think, was the area code. And I remember how when I went to jail there, they were extraditing me back. And 520, man, that's all you heard. Everybody was very proud of that. So I get what you're saying about the New Mexico thing. It kind of relates the same way.
Yeah, exactly. It's an affiliation that we all want to be tied to something. That's what I learned as I kind of grew up, is that we want to be tied and associated with something. And so the 520 in Arizona, in New Mexico is 505, Duke City. There's all kinds of different lingos that gets used that you can be affiliated with just a community. And that's right. What it ends up being. Now the community conscious, the decisions that are made in that community, those differ, but just like a frat, they same have thing. Rules.
Yeah, it's the same thing.
It's all the same thing. Just like church religions, they have community and they have rules there too. It's a community that people are searching for. And that's what I learned was that it was a community. And the community behaviors of the individuals that I chose to spend my time with were, hey, we earn money and we fight and we don't let anybody disrespect us.
We don't disrespect
women or children. And I was like, those are simple rules to follow. And I like those rules.
Yeah.
And yeah, that's kind of where the what some people would call the bad path started. For me, I don't like to determine them as bad paths, because without those paths, like, you wouldn't be the person that we are today, right?
No, we wouldn't, man. I did another show earlier today, and that's what I was telling her about. She doesn't know anything about that kind of life. And I said, you know, at the end of the day, yeah, I do wish my life would have went another path. But on the other hand, I'm proud of who I am today. And that's what did it. That's what molded it. Can I ask you how your sister is?
Yeah, thank you for asking. She's well. She's still alive. She has beautiful kids. She's married.
Awesome.
She's living what she wants to live. And yeah, so thank you for asking. She's still kicking. And she's a tough cookie, man. She's a
good
tough
deal. Those are things we want to hear, man. That's the good stuff we want to hear. All right. So at 14, you're running with the rough crowd, we'll just say. I'll say real quick, my childhood in a way was similar to yours, but a little bit different. I just, my mother was an alcoholic and drug addict. Dad, I don't even like calling him that, but he was never in my life. So mom was gone all the time. And then even when she got sober, she was gone at work all the time. And so I had those same feelings, unwanted. I never really grasped that I had those feelings until my wife. She's like, it's all because of that, you know, that abandonment issues, we'll call it. And it's kind of the same thing. You have to work through them that way. And it's a tough thing. But I found my way the same exact way almost, man. I was 15, wrong crowd. I did join into the gang, was manipulated and brainwashed and all kind of good stuff, you know, led me to believe I was someone that I wasn't. And I believed it for a long time, you know. And one day I just had this epiphany moment, and I said, hold on, man. You know, here, one hand, we're talking about God and all this, and the next hand, you got all this hate coming out of your mouth. Something's not right. Something's not jiving here, man. And I woke up to it. So what drug did you start using at first? Pot?
Yeah, cannabis was the first one that I started using. And when I first used it, Dane, you might be able to share this experience as well, but I was like, this is how other people must feel all the time. Yep. Like it wasn't so much that I enjoyed it, but so much that I was like, oh, that out of body experience that makes you feel like, oh, this is how other people must be seeing life. That's what I wanted. Like I didn't care about the substance. I just wanted to stop feeling the emotions that I had going on inside of my head that I didn't know how to communicate or share or discuss, or other than just feel them and know that they hurt. Cannabis was my first drug of choice.
How long did it take you to graduate into something different, man?
About a year and a half, 18 months.
Okay.
Right about that time frame, the pill market started to open up. So Xanax, Oxycontin, Percocets, hydrocodones, man, blues and buses were, those footballs were my thing. So Xanax followed up with some Oxy to come back down. I was like, oh, and it doesn't stink either. So
right,
you know, there was that hidden factor. So about 18 months, and I was constantly taking some sort of other hardcore drug when it comes to pharmaceuticals.
Right, right. Yeah, I started so young. Everybody wasn't taking pills. You know what I mean? Like I had an accident and got on them, but I went to prison and come back, man, and everybody I knew was on pills. That was when the Oxycontin craze came out or whatever. You know, they started pushing it on everybody. And I saw a lot of people, man, that I never would have believed would have been on pills that Still today, you don't have it together, you know, and they're not ready yet, man. You know, we can talk to them all we want. We can show them what it's doing. And until you're ready, though, it's just not going to happen for you, man.
I like how you said that because it gave me, you know, that awareness. I get chills whenever somebody speaks truth. And there's common truths that we all have to live by, right? And when you just said that they weren't ready, I think that's a portion that many individuals who haven't ever walked a life of substance use, haven't ever walked a life on the other side of the railroad tracks, haven't ever dabbled in that, they don't comprehend. They don't understand that it's a solution that somebody has found, and to ask them to decide to stop that solution, to find another solution that isn't immediately gratifying,
yep,
is detrimental to their mind. It doesn't make sense. And so until they can come to that conclusion that the decision that I'm making is mine, it never happens. And that's okay, right? Yeah. That they even get another day is all that matters to me. And how can we improve their quality of life, whether it's through conversation? Like, there's cats that I know, like you just said, that are still using, and it hurts me to see them using. But at the same time, I'm not going to pull up and be like, hey, bro, you need to stop. Instead, I'm going to pull up and be like, hey, what's up? How are you?
Yep.
What's going on with you? I'm going to treat you like a normal human being, because that's what you are. You just found a solution that I don't agree with. And there's lots of people who have solutions that I don't agree with. There's some who eat too much, and I don't agree with that, right?
Right.
And I don't treat them any differently. I still do my best to show them love. So I love how you said that portion of it, because it's just not their time.
No, and it's tough, man. It is tough when you see people. And I was just talking to a young kid right before we started. I met him in Florida years ago, and he's like the rest of us, man. He could have the world, you know what I mean? But again, he wants to keep dibbling and dabbling. And now he's done ended up in trouble, you know. And he's not bred for prison. He's not bred for prison. I'll say it that way. You know what I mean? And he's got another chance now. But again, all I can do is talk to him. I told him, man, listen, man, until you're ready, there's nothing. I'm not going to say anything to you that's going to change anything inside of you. I'm going to say some things, give you some nuggets to make you think, but you have to make that final decision, man, to realize, hey, I want more out of life, man. You know, success is different for each of us. You know, your idea of success is yours, mine is mine. And he's got an unbelievable work ethic. He's a good kid. And when I see that, it hurts me, man, because I'm 48 now. And I had people the same when I was young, try to talk to me the same way. I wouldn't listen either, you know, so I can't get mad at him. Like you said, I can just try to love him from afar. I don't try to directly let it impact my life. I'll say that.
Absolutely. Because, man, as it sounds like you have that trait of a healer, right? And as a true healer, you know that you can't heal anybody, but you can reveal to them where that healing happens. And that's internally. Yep, right. And that's what true healers do, is they plant the nuggets, plant the seeds, so that regardless of the path that he takes, that truth is then given to him. I like what some people call the 12 laws of the universe. And one of them is the law of exposure. Yep. And once you've been exposed to something, you can't be unexposed to it. So just by even planting the seed of putting the question out there, discussing with them about some of your personal experiences, that creates that law of exposure where now they know, you know, there's that old phrase that says, no one knows robbing is bad until you know robbing is bad.
Like, right. Yep. Exactly.
You're just trying to make ends meet. You're in a survival mode. So you don't know it's bad until you know it's bad. And then when you know it's bad, you have to consciously make the decision to participate in that negative behavior. I don't really want to call it bad. That negative decision consequences, or you deal with the positive consequences. And either one are available to all of us once we know it. And as you said, the only job we have is by sharing our experiences at a distance that's safe to make sure that we don't fall back into that flame. I can stand and I can withstand the heat for a little bit, but there's still some time that I got to back up and replenish myself, go take a nice cool walk in the breeze and remind myself that, hey, you still got your life, and you can't save anybody.
No, we can't, man. And that's what, you know, my wife tried to save me for a long time. And then she finally realized, hey, I can't do it. You know, I've done all I can do. And she's definitely, you know, a godsend to me. She's definitely an angel. I'd say that someone who finally believed in me, I'll say it that way, and kind of woke up, man, to me realizing I did have more in life, you know, because again, I believed I was supposed to be this tough guy and all this stuff. And there ain't nothing cool about that, man. You know what I mean? And it's cool. You can take care of yourself and all that. But, you know, you're not going to get anywhere just with your hands like that way. It's with your heart, man, your mind, you know. And that's what I do this show for, is because I want people to see, man, you know, like so many of us, I've had a bad way, man. Now, I caused it. Don't get me wrong. It's my decisions that caused it. But it's been a rough ride. And I don't want to see other people go through it. And if I can help them, I'm going to do all I can to do that. Let me ask you, so when you started taking the pills and stuff, how much did your life change?
Oh, my life 180'd. So when I started taking the pills, I got to give a little bit more backstory on that.
All right.
I started working when I was 14 years old, mainly because I wanted to drop out of school. Like, I didn't see the point in going to school myself. So I wanted to drop out, and Mama Dukes, man, she wasn't having it. She's like, you're going to be a high school graduate at the bare minimum. But she thought that teaching me the hard way was going to help me. And so she got me a job as a laborer on a construction site. And work ethic, my dad instilled into me, my papa instilled into me. So I was good at working. And I made, you know, a few hundred bucks every week working construction. And it was good money for a 14-year-old who doesn't have any type of responsibilities. Definitely. But I also learned how to make a dollar turn into $5.
Right.
And so it wasn't just using the pills, but I also had the opportunity of moving the pills.
Yeah.
And at that point, you didn't have to go see the big homie anymore. You didn't have to go see the dude on the corner anymore.
That's right. These
pills were being offered by hundreds more of individuals because many people had them. Mm-hmm. And when I understood that the demand was high and that the supply was high, I just made the connection. I had the connecting conduit, which was cash.
Cash.
If I didn't have cash, then I had what they wanted, cocaine. Cocaine, a lot of the individuals that I knew that were older, that was their substance of choice. They loved it. And so I just go buy me an ounce of coke and trade them for all their pills. And the per dollar trade on that, I was getting a good return on $400. I was getting a great return on my money. So my life changed 180 degrees because I saw the profit margins. I saw the return on the investment financially. I saw the opportunity to be accepted. I saw the way to make it out. Right. And I had this whole plan of sell enough drugs to buy a moving truck and have this moving truck open up into a business because everybody's moving all the time. Like, once a month, someone's got to move somewhere. So why not just be the one that puts it all in the truck and moves? So my life changed because I had a plan that I saw a small light of hope that I could get out of the situation that I had seen my dad in. My dad worked all the time. My mom, she worked all the time. They were present very much so whenever they could be. And I had them around more than most people had their parents around that were around me, but I could see the struggle that it was. One of the guys I like to listen to, he says, money ran out before the month ran out, right?
Right.
Mm-hmm. And so I just wanted to get that situation solved. So by pills, I saw that solution happening, and I saw the solution of being accepted happening. And then I took them once because I broke the rules of the game, and I was like, holy cow, this is better than smoking weed. Like, this is slowing down my brain to a place where I can actually think. It wasn't constant thoughts going back and forth, ping-ponging all over my brain, having to do this, having to do that, having to think about this, having to think about that, having past events, having present events, having future events, all these thoughts just firing off in my head. I didn't have a system for controlling my thoughts.
Right.
And the pills slowed down my thinking so that I could at least manage my thoughts. So there was three different ways that it changed my life 180 degrees, because I found a mental solution, I found a financial solution, and I found an emotional solution. And I keep on calling it solutions. And if anybody's listening, you might be wondering why I call it solutions. It's because that's what it is. Like, for an individual in that state of mind, a survival mode, a state where they have problems all around them, that's a solution.
Without a doubt.
I was I do some work locally, and I was at a school, a middle school, and I was having a conversation with a group of individuals who the school deems as high risk. I call them great opportunity students. And that's how I talk to them. I let them know that you guys are smarter than you think. You just haven't learned to direct it. You're limiting your options. And right now, the options that are available are far greater than just selling whatever you're selling,
right?
Selling vapes, selling pills, selling bottles of liquor that you guys are stealing. Your options are far greater because you have the internet available to you. And right now you can get on the internet and make a few hundred bucks if you just put your mind to it.
Yeah.
And so that solution talk is how I like to present it, because that's what it is. And being able to have those solutions changed my life, because I finally had something consistent. I had something that wasn't ever going to change. I had a money solution as long as I knew how to move the product. I had an emotional solution as I was getting connection with people. I was meeting new people all the time. And that for me was a greater high than anything else. People right. were excited to see Nico pull up. Like people were like, oh yeah, Nico's the guy, man. I'd sell pills for $60 to the homies that were from the same demographics that I was from, but that upper echelon neighborhood, $120. And both yeah. of them loved me, right? So being able to sit in both of those rooms was for me just, it was so great. So I had these solutions, but the one that caught me was breaking those rules, because there is rules to the game and you can't break them.
Yep.
And I broke one of them, and that breaking of the rule got away with it only for a little bit of time until I was probably about 18 years old. And then I found myself going through withdrawals, and that's when I understood I had messed up.
Yeah. That's what I was going to ask you. How long did it take you to go through the withdrawals?
Yes.
Yeah, or to get to that point.
Yeah. I was about 18 years old. I had earned a full ride wrestling scholarship. Because that was my outlet. I was like, if it wasn't drugs, then I was wrestling.
Right.
And I got me a full ride wrestling scholarship. I was going to be the first one in my family to have an athletic scholarship, right? Go to college right out of school. And I found myself one night not being able to sleep and just having the shivers, having the shakes. My yeah. mind was hurting. My body was hurting. And I couldn't figure out why. Well, wrestling season had just started and I stopped using pills. I stopped taking any type of substance. I still had them, but I wasn't taking them myself. And I remember calling one of my homies. I'm like, "Doc, I can't sleep. I don't know what's going on." He's like, "Nico, why don't you take one of your pills? Like, just take a little bit of it and see if they go away." So I took a little bit of it, took about a quarter of an Oxy 80, and it went away.
Yeah,
that's when I was like, oh shit, you got to make a decision. And consciously, I knew that I was making the wrong decision by continuing to choose to use drugs. But unconsciously, I didn't want to stop.
Right.
Like, it had solved all of my problems. I wasn't going to give this up. So to give that up was like out of the question for me. And so I was about 18 years old when I quit wrestling altogether, and I went into full-time hustling, working 9 to 5, just so that everybody around me didn't ask me where my money came from.
Right.
You know, I had some nice things, but people were like, "Oh, he's working a job." Like, yeah, working a job.
Yeah.
And at work, I wouldn't really work. I just network. And that's one of the skills that I think a lot of individuals overlook, is that there's a skill set that Dane, you have, right? There's a skill set. I could already hear it. You're a great communicator of ideas. There's a skill set that we have, but we just use them in the incorrect way. And me, it's relationship building. I love interacting with people and building relationships and just offering, being of service to them. That's how I used to think of being a drug dealer was. It was just of service to other individuals. Really wasn't giving them good service, but that's how I thought, right?
Yeah.
And so seeing those type of events, going through withdrawals and making those decisions, as I look back, at 18 years old, and then by the time I'm 20, they had stopped manufacturing pills the way that they manufactured pills. So the epidemic of opioids, came into the mix. And geographically, I'm sure that you know this just because you've been all around the South, but New Mexico, we have a corridor here, and that corridor is straight from Mexico all the way up to the Midwest.
Yes, sir. So
getting narcotics for me wasn't difficult. And the price, because there's such a high supply coming through, wasn't that large.
Nope.
And when the pills stopped, heroin boomed, and tar, man, that solution as it was presented to me was, "Hey, Nico, your customers, they still want to get high. Why don't you give them this instead of the tar? Or, I'm sorry, this instead of the pills. Why don't you do that?" And I was like, yeah, let's go. Let's keep it moving because the profit margins are still within the amount of money that I need to be making to fill that ego. Because at that point, it's ego.
Ego. You're right. Yeah. I remember when I went up to Arizona, man, you know, it's a border town too. And the price of heroin was just like, you got to be kidding me. I couldn't believe it. And here I went. Yeah, it was cheap. I don't remember what the prices were now, but like here in Nashville, it was $200 a gram, I'll say, at that time for black tar heroin, you know. And so, yeah. And so then that started the whole, well, let's see if I can maybe make some from here to there. And, you know the deal. It's the same thing, man. Did you start doing the heroin?
Yes, I did start doing the heroin. And that's when I really went off track. That's when the homies, because I had to go back to the big homies to get the heroin. That wasn't as readily available as the pills were. So I started going back to the homies that I was moving coke for. And they were moving heroin at that point too. So I started using it. And that's where things went really left. Because they're like, Nico, you're good on that coke game because you don't use it. But that heroin's got you mixed up. So we're not fronting you anymore.
Yeah.
And I was getting a few ounces every week fronted. So I'd keep a quarter ounce for myself to get high with me and my chick and whoever I needed to break off to go do some work for me, go get some groceries for me, to do the normal stuff for me. That changed. So, Nico, we're not fronting you 4 ounces anymore. We'll give you a ounce. Well, a quarter of that still needed to be used to keep me going. 3/4 is going to make back a little bit of money, but it ain't making everything else. And so my whole system was thrown into a whirlwind because I was using heroin. And then my girl at the time, or a girl I should say, that I was hanging out with at the time, she introduced me to blasting. I had been freebasing it, but she introduced me to blasting. She's like, it'll last longer. And she showed me how to rig a needle. She showed me how to hit a vein. And from there, I was just off to the tracks. I didn't care what I needed to do to get high. I was going to get high. I didn't care what kind of needle I needed to use. I was going to get high. I didn't care who I needed to be around. I was going to get high. So sharing needles, fish hook and needles, like robbing places that we shouldn't have been robbing, people that we shouldn't have been robbing, all took its toll. And eventually I found myself exactly where I didn't want to be, rejected again. So the communities that I had loved so much, because there was a love there, and people freak out when you say that, like, nah, there's a love there. There's a brotherhood there.
Without a doubt.
There is a community there that's connected. And when that gets taken away from you, man, those feelings of abandonment, they kicked back in again. And because I had positioned myself as somebody whose only asset was being able to move a product, I didn't position myself as anything other than that. When that asset got removed from me, I was no longer a asset to that brotherhood. So
that's right.
Why would we need Nico around anymore? We need to go find someone else who can move these products.
Yep. Yeah. I went down the IV lane myself, man. I started at the age of 17. K4 Dilaudid was the first thing that I ever done. I didn't shoot heroin until I was 35, but the first time I'd done it, later that day, my best friend OD'd and died. You'd think I would have stopped, but I kept on doing it. And
probably then asked for where he got his stuff from, no?
No, he was the one that got it. It was kind of, we were in a program, and I'd been sober about a year. My mother got sick and went to the hospital. He mentioned something about getting a pill. Couldn't get a pill. Come up with this heroin. Does it, and it just wipes me out. You know what I mean? So he has to take me home. Then he called me at like 7 o'clock, wanted to know if I wanted something from McDonald's. But what he was really asking me was if I wanted some more heroin. But I was still so high that I didn't really catch on. And they found him in his car the next day at 1 o'clock. So he went and got it and did it, and he OD'd there. So that was before fentanyl, you know, that's pre-fentanyl stuff there. That was the black tar. But by the time it got here, it was so stepped on, it was almost like a off tan color, you know. You know what the real black tar looks like out there. And but still, it was still strong enough to take him out, man. And so that was, you, I look back on that a lot and I think, man, you know, why did you go on and continue doing heroin. I went on the run. That's when I went to Arizona. I went on the run. They were trying to put me in jail for him dying. I had nothing to do with it, you know, type of deal. And so, yeah, I know all about the demon of the needle, man. That just, it's a whole different demon.
Well, also, what I just heard you say is that you also know the demon of the system, too. Because at that point, there wasn't the laws that are in place now where, you know, when you, I remember those time frames when somebody overdosed and died, you just left. It didn't matter if it was your closest homie. It didn't matter who it was, because you knew that if you got even caught in that environment, you were going to be tagged as some, they're going to try to put the murder on you. Like,
the thing about that was, is that I wasn't even with him. We were just in what's called drug court. I don't know if they have that in New Mexico or not. They probably do. And we lived in the same house together. And so they needed someone to blame, you know what I mean? Basically type of deal, because they're corrupt as all corrupt can be. And they wanted to blame me. And my mother died, he died. My mother died on, he died on a Saturday. My mother died the following Wednesday.
Wow.
And they put me in jail on Thursday. Wouldn't let me go to his funeral. Then gave me a furlough to go to hers, and caught me 18 months later in Tucson, Arizona. Didn't turn myself back in, but they kept trying to blame me for him, man. And I was like, no. They even went so far as to say, well, they got you on camera getting out of his car, which was a lie. You know, I wasn't with him, you know, but nowadays, you know, here, I don't know about there, but they're charging you now here. Now I know a couple of kids who sold fentanyl and people died, and they're giving them 12 years for it. They're not playing, but you know, I don't want to get into all that conspiracy stuff, but I think our government's tied into all that too. So, you know, with all the drugs, I just feel that way, but whether or not they are, I don't know, man.
Yeah. Yeah. History will tell us eventually.
Eventually.
It'll show, but that whole, and I can even say this cause it's factual. Here in New Mexico, we got what's called, we got a few million dollars from a federal case because of the opioid pharmaceuticals. They were targeting specific areas, and two of the most targeted areas within the Southwest were here in Albuquerque. There was two Walgreens that were being overprescribed opiates, and that it was just flooding the area. There is a city up north, northern New Mexico, they were targeting as well. Specifically, they have it on their pharmaceutical records that they would ship more than needed for the population to these areas. And so, you know, we can take indicators from that as to why they were directed to specific areas. That for sure has been factual, you know, for speaking facts on that. Because like you said, we can throw our feelings into it. We can throw our thoughts and our theory into it. But as you and I both know, that those don't mean jack unless you have facts.
That's right.
Facts are what matter. And so factually, this past year, New Mexico got a few million dollars. I think they call it the opioid relief fund or something like that. I forget what they called it. But I do some work in the community with government branches now that are wanting to figure out ways to use the funds, because there's not really regulations on how they have to use the funds. Like, it's not directed towards, hey, you have to create so many treatment centers, you have to do so much work inside the jails. They just gave the money to the state, and the counties and the cities get to, are the only oversight. So I get to go in and I get to give my opinion on whether the funds are being spent in a fashion that can be beneficial to the communities that are actually impacted, because this fentanyl crisis is crazy. And it's another ploy to keep the prisons, privately owned prisons. I'm going to say
there
that.
There you go. There you said it. You are,
in a profit margin that is currently needed for them to keep on running, because a lot of people don't understand our prison system isn't, it's not government ran, it's private owned. And so they get paid certain amount of dollars for every head in the bed and every meal that they get to throw on a tray.
And all these people own stock in it, man. You know, I've delved in a little bit deeper on that. We don't have a lot of them here. There's only four in the state of Tennessee that are privately owned. What used to be called CCA. I'm sure it's the same thing out there. I think they call it CCS or something now, but it's all the same thing. And My wife works in treatment, and she has a lady come in. Her son was found dead in one of them, and they won't tell her anything, man. Tell her if she wants to find out, she has to have a lawyer. And there's been many people that way, and that's what we're kind of on a journey on now. We're going to try to get that voice out because it's sad, man, Nico. I mean, to just say the least, man. The difference here in the state-run prisons, it's not no good either, don't get me wrong, but the privately owned, it's horrible, man. It's just the way that you live in there and the way you're treated, and you're not going to make parole in them, man. I don't care. You can take every program they got, not getting no write-ups, but it's the same thing. That bed, that head in that bed, where's the cattle? We're the new cattle, man. You know,
absolutely. I did
21 years. Should I have done 21 years for my crimes? No, man. I had all property crimes, nothing. You know what I mean? But, you know, I wasn't innocent either. You know, and I did get in trouble in there, but it was kind of a product of the system. What are you going to do? You know, you're going to be a man, you're going to be a mouse. You got no choice. I mean, you're in there with the worst of the worst. And so that comes with write-ups, and there you are staying longer. And they would give me parole, and I had never fixed the problem, which was me and the drug problem. And so it's right back in, man, right back in. And we were talking about it. I said, you know, even when I was on parole, I could be doing fine, no drugs in my system, but they'd call me in for a drug test, and I'd instantly be so full of stress and nervous, and because these people are in control of your life, and I know they're not no good, man. You know, we should be punished for our crimes, don't get me wrong, and the things that we do. But whenever I do 21 years and I see someone that harmed a child do 5, we've got a problem. We've got a problem, man. You know what I mean? We've got a problem. And
yeah,
it's just, there's no, I don't know about New Mexico, but there's no programs here. I did all that time and I never was offered no kind of drug program, no kind of nothing the whole time.
Jeez. So
it's sad. It's really sad. And I know they get all this money here too and do nothing with it. So yeah. All right, man. So you start down that spiral, man, with a needle. How long were you strung out?
A few years. So I started off on the needle about 20, and by 22, I was just on the streets.
Yeah.
That's how quick it went for me. So, I mean, blessed to say that it was only 2 years.
Right.
But it was a hectic 2 years. It was, those 2 years felt like 20 years, because sure, each day was a struggle. Each day was, where am I going to get the next lick so I can go get the next bag, so I can go get the next needle, so I can go get the next high? That high is only going to last for a small amount of time, so I already got to start planning my next lick so I can go and get the next bag, so I can get the next needle. And then it's a small community. Albuquerque's a little big town, so where I had to plan out my strategy, like, all right, I'm going to go target this area of town for a couple days and then bail out from there and go target another area of town for a couple days.
Right.
And that's how I'd move. So it 2 years, now that I look back, I'm like, dang, 2 years wasn't that long. But in that 2 years, the amount of moments that were just so extreme, so life-changing. I remember getting caught. I'd done some things that I shouldn't have done, robbed some people that I shouldn't have robbed. And I was going through the drive-thru at a local McDonald's, and one of the homies with me, we had gotten high. We had gotten some extra cash too. So we were wanting to treat ourselves to food, because, you know, that's the last thing on your mind when you're a dope fiend. Like, that's a treat to us, a couple of double cheeseburgers and a hot spicy and some fries.
It's a big deal.
Yeah, absolutely. That $5 right there, that's like $6-7, and that's taken away from our dope money, you know, because that's your main priority. But I remember that we're in the drive-thru, and all of a sudden, my homie taps me. He's like, look, and we see one of the homies of the guys that we had just robbed, and he sees us. And, well, we're stuck in a drive-thru. My homie pulls out his pistol, and he starts looking at us. Well, luckily enough, we were strapped too. My homie grabs a shotgun from underneath the seat and he points it back at him like, what's up, dog? If we're going to do this, we're going to do it. I grab my strap. I'm like, if we're going to do this, we're going to do it, because I can't get out of this drive-through. It's blocked on this side, blocked on my right side. My left side is where you're at. And if I go straight ahead, there's cars. Like, I don't have an out. So the only out that we're going to get is a shootout. And right. when he saw the shotgun raise and then he saw me with my pistol and I showed it to him, he knew he was outgunned. And at that point, that's the only thing that defused the situation. I see him get on the phone immediately. And I was like, yeah, he's calling his people. We got to get out of here, dog. I was like, why don't you keep an eye on him? Keep that strap ready. And let's just get through this drive-thru. And sitting in that drive-thru felt like days because I was like, man, I don't know where his people are at. They come around the corner and it's over for us in a matter of instant. And that's just a small instance of where I was at with that situation because the needle, it'll drive you to do some crazy things. Just the high will drive you to do some crazy things. Things that even looking back now, I get still, my stomach turns because of some of the things that I've done. And like I said, there was rules that we followed. You didn't hurt any people that weren't in the game. You never mess with them and you never mess with any children or women. Like,
right.
So we followed certain rules, but even the rules that we didn't follow, it became a very aggressive, hostile lifestyle. And at that point, 130 pounds, maybe. Like right now, I sit at 200. There, I was 120 pounds, 130 pounds, acting like a dummy.
Yeah.
And thinking that the world was mine because all I had to do was get another sack. That's all I had to do.
That's the only thing on your mind, man. No matter what we got to do to get it. It's sad. It really is, you know, let something take us that far in life, man. But we do, you know. How did you get sober, man?
So that's the crazy part. Sobriety for me was not a AA. It wasn't NA. It wasn't treatment centers. I really struggle with being told what to do, Dane.
Right.
Like, I cannot stand it. I love to help people. I love to serve people. And even now when I'm working with individuals that I work with, just on my own, I'm like, you could ask me for almost anything. And if I can get it done for you, I will. I have pool. I have ways. I have resources, both in many different areas and aspects. But you tell me I need to do something and you're going to see a switch go off in my head that it's hard for me to shut off because I have an animosity of being told what to do. So when I went to treatment centers and they said that I had to go in for 30 days, I was like, yeah, screw you guys. You're going to tell me what to do for 30 days? Hell no.
No, not happening.
Yeah, the homies who had been in and out of jail, because I've never participated in getting caught, I was always taught, hey, you pay a lawyer. So for me, having lawyers around was natural. So I avoided jail. But they always told me, Nico, why would you even go inside to get clean? Because that used to go through my head. Let me go inside, get clean. They're like, why? Shit's in there too, Nico. So don't even waste your time. And then I go to various programs. And I want to highlight this. I'm not knocking any of the programs, but they weren't my path. And there's many paths to sobriety. So I love that you asked that question because I found my path both through spiritually connecting with my God and then personally working on myself. Physically, what I did was I titrated. So I would get enough just to not hurt. I get enough to feel well, and that's where I'd stop. I started to develop my own willpower for self-control. So instead of shooting up 2 grams, 3 grams to get high, I was only using a gram to get well.
Right.
And that's how I tapered myself off of opiates. And again, I remember one day I was having a conversation with my God. I was like, look, if you're real, then take this pain away from me. Like, just take this away from me, please. And I'll do anything that you say, you know, making a deal with God. And
right.
when you believe that you're talking to him, he's going to show up. And I had some Suboxones that I had bought off the street because that's where I was at. I didn't need to use anymore, but I knew I needed something as a go-to for when my brain lost its willpower. And so Suboxone for me was the opportunity. I bought a couple of tabs of Suboxone and I cut them in quarters because I was like, if anything, dude, like you're doing this on your own, you don't have any paperwork for it. And if you get caught with Suboxone, it was the same as a substance. So
right. It
wasn't any different. I was still living in that criminal mindset. I just asked for help. And I remember the next day I woke up and I just had this freeing feeling. Just this uplifting lightness. And I didn't need to take a sub that morning. I didn't need to take any type of medically assisted treatment. And even though I was doing it all on my own, independently of any type of doctor, I followed the knowledge that my homies had taught me from their mat treatments, the knowledge that my homies had taught me from when they went to treatment, when they went to AA, when they went to NA. And that's how I ended up kicking heroin, was removing it. I remember the last time that I had to use a man, I was at 60 cc's and it was, it looked like tea water. It wasn't even like black. It looked like tea water. And I was just slamming that. And that's how I ended up kicking, was by harm reduction is what it's technically called. Yeah. Titrating is the other version of it, until I only needed Suboxone. And then from Suboxone, I was like, I'm not going to replace one for the other and become dependent on it, which I'm not knocking anybody who does. There's homies that I still have who are like, Nico, I still go get my subs every day. I'm like, cool, bro. As long as it's not, as long as it's improving your quality of life, I don't care.
I'm for the same me, way.
Though, I didn't need it. I couldn't. Again, my issue with authority was, hey, this Suboxone has authority over me. And I don't even want that. Like, it didn't have to be a person. I didn't want a substance to have control over me.
Yeah, I feel you on that authority thing, man. It seems like I had a lot of authority on my life too. But I'm the same way with Suboxone. Each his own. As long as it's improving your quality of life and you're becoming a better person and all these different things that we're supposed to be doing in recovery, I'm not against it. Methadone, on the other hand, it's a little bit different. But Suboxone, I'm all about it, really. Some people may need it, you know, and some don't, you know. And if that's keeping you from slamming a needle in your arm, and now you're not stealing from your family and robbing and doing all these things and being productive, hey, by all means, take it, man. Yeah. So you wrote, tell me about the book you wrote.
So the book I wrote is 5 Things to Know Before You Get Sober. Okay. I started working on myself, and I got introduced to this gentleman by the name of E.T., the hip hop preacher. Okay. I was scrolling through YouTube, and one day I hear him come across it was a commercial that I heard of his, and what he was describing is exactly what I knew in my heart to be true, that you have to change who you are internally before you can change anything around you externally. You have to identify as somebody who isn't going to use substances. And he was talking about it as something different. He was going through his own issues, but I was like, that's a truth. That's a universal truth right there. And so I started studying all this information that YouTube, man, it's a university.
Without
so I
a doubt.
Started studying, like every piece of content that I could get from him, I started studying. And then I learned of a couple other guys, Les Brown, Zig Ziglar, Jim Rohn. And I was like, holy cow, there's a whole industry of these individuals who are teaching what needs to be taught in a fashion that is consumable and digestible in my own time frame. Because some of the stuff I didn't understand, and cool, I'll come back to it, but the stuff that I did understand, I would take and I would apply it, and I would apply it to the T. Just like when I was moving dope, everything was to the T. I applied this information to the T. And that's what changed. It was personal development for me. And I still view it as that. Each and every day I wake up, and how am I going to get better? What am I going to do better? I got that tattooed on my hand because it's so important to me to keep that at the forefront of my mind, that I do better today. And when I got involved in their communities, little more and more, going to seminars, going to online webinars, going to conferences, one of the things that they described is, you know what, you have a skill set inside of you from everything that you've been through, regardless of what it is. You have a skill set, you have a piece of knowledge that you can share with the community. And how you share that is up to you. And then they just start to describe different ways to share it, right? You can make podcasts, you can make books, you can make recordings, you can make videos. And I was like, a book sounds great. Like, I like to stand out. I still got that. I still got that built into me. You know what I'm saying? Yeah. I got to stand out a little bit.
Yeah.
And nobody that I knew was an author. So I was like, I'm going to be the first author. And what do I know? Well, I know how to get sober without going to a treatment. And I noticed that there was a gap. You know, that's the name of the hustling game. You find the gap and you fill it. And that's where you make your money. And the gap that I saw was that there was a lot of content and books on what to do when you're sober, what to do to maintain your sobriety. But nobody was talking about what to do to before you get sober. Like,
right.
There's thousands of people that are stuck in that roadblock right there. They're trying to figure it out. clinically, I've learned that it is the contemplation stage, right? Right before you start taking any type of preparations, right before you start taking any type of actions, you're contemplating whether this is something for you or not. And so I specifically wrote the book for those individuals who are in that contemplation preparation stage, because there's five things that I think people should know before they get sober. First one is it's a choice. Regardless of how you address it, it's a choice. Right. Whether you want to call it a disease, whether you want to call it a moral failure, whether you want to call it a genetic defect, I don't care what you call it, but are you going to address it?
Right.
That's the choice that you have. You want to call it a spiritual issue, a spiritual warfare, demons. Great. Are you going to choose to fight them or not? So it's a choice. And through the times that I had gotten clean, I noticed these patterns. Mm-hmm. The book describes those patterns in five simple ways.
Right. That's awesome, man. Where can we find your book at?
Amazon, or if you really want to support your boy, you can find it at my website, nohalonm.com.
All right, man. Are you working on any more books now?
Yeah, I got three more in the mix. One is a mindful book because I'm a firm believer in mindset. The other one is going to be, now I'm going to write a book on what to do now that you're sober.
Okay.
How to maintain sobriety. I want to put it into a three-book series, right? Before you get sober, now that you're sober, and how to maintain it.
Awesome, man. I want to say it's an honor I got to meet you, man. I like your story. I like hearing the different stories of people who don't use what we would call the traditional way of getting clean or sober, whatever word you want to use. I met a guy that he was alcoholic, and he got sober on a bet, man. He wanted to keep his word, and he lost the bet, so he had to get sober, and that's been 30 years ago.
Hell
so,
yeah.
Or 1998, so whatever that is now.
It's yeah, close awesome. Enough, man. That's great.
All right, man. It's been an honor to meet you, man. Like I said, listen, anytime you have another book coming out, man, shoot me an email. We'll get you back on, get you some publicity for it. Tell us again one more time your website again.
Website is nohalonm.com.
All right, my friend. You have a good day. God bless. I'll talk to you again, my friend.
Thanks, Dane. I appreciate the time, bro. I had a conversation.
Look forward to it again, man. See you.
Later.